You know, you always suspect that there's something lurking back there, lurking behind what we're watching unfold in the world of science. A brave new world. My goodness, Huxley certainly was prophetic there, wasn't he? And it came so much quicker than the rest of us thought it would. Well, we're going to be talking in the first 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. about one of the things that seems to prevail behind the brave new world of medicine and medical research we often talk about here on Issues, Etc. A postmodernism and a postmodern way of thinking where truth and morality is relative. That's why we can have much of what we have by way of medical research today. That's why the language that is often used to sell these things to the public or to the culture is so often fuzzy, blurry around the edges, and why people who are otherwise very concerned about truth and accuracy, like scientists or medical researchers, when it comes to talking about what they're doing in their labs, they're not so accurate. They're more willing to allow the language to be less than accurate. We're going to talk about that in the first part of Issues, Etc. today. Wesley Smith of the Discovery Institute will be our guest. In the second half hour, moving into the second hour of the program, from 3:30 to 4, we have open lines for your questions and your comments. A question I want to lay on the table for you after we hear from an official on this cleric that is holed up in Najaf, the holy city in Iraq. No one wants to go in. No one has gone in. Should we go in? There was a wall of a mosque that was bombed because it was believed, I believe, in Fallujah, that there were, well, some bad men up to no good who were using it as a headquarters. We know this is happening. Mosques are believed by Muslims to be holy places. Some of the cities are holy places. Is it time to take off the gloves? And look, we've shown we respect your religion, but now we got to deal with the bad men up to no good, even if they're hiding in your mosques and your shrines and your holy places. We'll talk about that during Open Lines. Plus, a church, we talked about it last year. It happened again this year. Church decided to give away a car for Easter Sunday. Okay? Guess who won it? A 9-year-old girl won it, and then she decided she was going to give it to the person who invited her to church. That's a heart-touching story. We'll hear from what the pastor at that church has to say, why they were giving a car away, and what he thought the basic lesson was that was learned by one and all when they gave away a car to a little girl, and she gave it away in turn to the person who invited her to church. That during Open Lines from 3:30 to 4:30 here on Issues, Etc. Picking up at 4:30, we're going to be talking with Dr. Frank Beckwith. He'll spend an hour talking with us about political correctness. Where did it come from? What does it mean? And does it hold water? These notions that, well, your truth is your truth, my truth is my truth, but you better watch what you say lest you step on my truth. Speech codes, political correctness, multiculturalism. We'll talk about all of those things with Dr. Frank Beckwith from 4:30 to 5:30 in the last half hour of Issues, Etc. Robert Spencer joins us. He's author of the book Onward, Muslim Soldiers, and also one called Islam Unveiled. We talked with him before. We're going to talk with him about Islam and the war with Iraq. What's really behind this? Are we underestimating Islam as a religion and thereby paying the price as we wage war in a nation of Muslims? That's the lineup for Issues, Etc. today. I'm Todd Wilkin. You can join us at any time, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Had a day off yesterday post-Easter. We're back live Tuesday, the 13th of April. I should know because I sat down this morning and did my taxes, well aware of the fact that I had 2 days to file them, got them all filed, all is well, but I should be well aware of the date, you would think, here in the middle of April. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Wesley Smith is a regular guest. He's an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide. He's also a senior fellow for the Discovery Institute. He's authored several books, including Culture of Death, The Assault on Medical Ethics in America, and he's written a recent column titled Postmodernism Comes to Science. Wesley, welcome back.
Hi, Todd. How are you?
I'm doing well, Wesley. How about you?
Pretty well, thank you.
And your Easter?
It was blessed.
Good, as was mine. You know, scientists usually have the reputation for accuracy, clear thinking, articulating their findings in clear language that cannot be mistaken one thing for another. Is that what's happening in science and medical research nowadays?
Well, it does happen, of course, in science and medical research in terms of the hard science. But what is really going on here, and I think it's very upsetting and very frightening, is that science has become incredibly, I call it hyper-political, particularly over the controversies that we've discussed on this show before, such as cloning, human cloning, and embryonic stem cell research. You know, whether or not we should proceed with human cloning or embryonic stem cell research is not a science issue. It is an ethical issue. It is a moral issue. It is a philosophical issue. It is a religious issue. It is not a science issue. Science can tell us what it hopes to achieve if we go forward. Science can tell us what is created in terms of what kind of organism is created through cloning, but it can't tell us whether it's moral or not. The problem is, and I call it postmodernism, you know, postmodernism says nothing can be defined, everything is relative, and classic example of postmodernism is when you want to obtain a desired end, and the definitions that exist now impede that, well, you just change the definitions. And that's what's happening in this debate. Science is corrupting itself in order to win the cloning debate. So that rather than saying, for example, and this is biologically indisputable, the product of cloning is an embryo. That is biologically indisputable. Dolly the sheep began as a sheep embryo. She was implanted into a ewe, gestated, and born as a lamb. She was a cloned embryo. She became a cloned sheep fetus, and she ended up a cloned lamb and a cloned sheep. That's biology. But when it comes to human cloning, which would be the same thing, it cloned the product of a human somatic cell nuclear transfer is a cloned human embryo. They've already been created in South Korea. If you implanted that cloned embryo, it would and it developed normally, it would become a cloned human fetus and then a baby, a cloned baby. That's the biology. And that's the science we need an accurate depiction of so that we can engage in the important moral debate. Does it matter whether we are talking about creating a new human life for the purpose of researching it and destroying it as therapeutic cloning would permit? Does that matter? That's not a science issue. That's a moral issue, a philosophical issue, an ethical issue, a religious issue. But in order to have that important debate, the science, which is objective and not subject to argument in that sense, needs to be precise. But the scientists, because they know they'll lose the debate if they admit we're talking about making new human life, just basically say, well, we're going to redefine it. And so they say it's just a bunch of cells, or they say it's just something else. And it's a corruption of science, and it disrespects the American people.
It seems often they kind of have an out here, Wesley, where they'll say, "Okay, look, we didn't say, of course, that the product of human cloning was a human embryo. What we did say was the product of human cloning was a line of stem cells. All we did really was just kind of skip" the part that we consider to be less than relevant to the public understanding what we're getting to here. I mean, if we start talking about human embryos, people will get confused. We want to get to the point that we got stem cells from the result of this. And after all, that's what's going to help everyone in the end. How do you respond to this?
Well, it's like saying, well, I shot that person to get his organs, that person. And it's like saying, well, let's do away with the shooting of the person. We just talk about, look, we got these organs for transplant. You can't do that and allow for a respectful debate, because the moral issue has to do, at least partially, with how those stem cells are extracted and what they are extracted from. And so when they say, we just don't want to confuse the American public, what they're saying is, we don't want the American public to come to conclusions with which we disagree, so we as scientists are going to make some unscientific statements and call it science because we're scientists. But a scientist can say the moon is made of blue cheese. That doesn't make it science.
Does it surprise you that you've already touched upon one, and that is what you have repeatedly called on this program, the false distinction between therapeutic and reproductive cloning? But does it surprise you that the American public has pretty much swallowed that distinction without a worry?
I don't think they really have. And I think that's why the scientists and big biotech advocates keep changing the terminology. The American people do support, polls show, embryonic stem cell research only if you take a human embryo left over from IVF treatments, in vitro fertilization, that are going to be discarded anyway. Remember that argument? That's only 3 or 4 years ago, 2001, 3 years ago, we were having that argument. And the idea behind that was, well, they're going to be destroyed anyway, we might as well get some use out of it.
Right.
Remember?
Yes.
That was the appealing to the pragmatic streak in the American people. People accepted that, and by a majority, support embryonic stem cell research under those limited conditions. But as soon as that argument was over, the big biotech industry and the research scientists, who, by the way, you know, at the universities, they're very now closely affiliated with big business. Often, you know, you've heard of the term publisher perish, where university professors and researchers, in order to obtain tenure and to maintain their positions of respect in the academic community, publish learned papers that share knowledge. But that's changing. I call it patenter perish. Now, before they put the word out as to what's going on, they rush out and patent and hope to become part of a big biotech industry so they can make a lot of money. This is happening a lot now, particularly in the life sciences. So what you find is that the science community and the big biotech community started to change the definitions as soon as that debate over funding of embryonic stem cell research was over. Suddenly, it wasn't just leftover IVF embryos they wanted, but they wanted therapeutic cloning, which is creating embryos for the purpose of destruction through the somatic cell nuclear transfer procedure. When the American people didn't go for that, and they opposed cloning of human life regardless of what the purpose was, they then said, okay, we're not going to call it cloning anymore. We're going to call it somatic cell nuclear transfer for stem cells, if you're going to use the embryo in research. But if it's for a baby, we're still going to call it cloning so that we can try to create a false distinction. But it really hasn't worked. The American people do not support cloning of human life. And polls show that repeatedly. So now what they're doing is they're redefining it again, and they're now saying that somatic cell nuclear transfer is embryonic stem cell research. And this, again, isn't science. It's polemics. It's advocacy. And it's based on a desire to hide from the American people what is actually being advocated.
We're talking about postmodern science with Wesley Smith. Feel free to join us with a question or a comment, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. You've mentioned in previous conversations, Wesley, that there's also some fudging of the math here. It seems as though big biotech, even some scientific journals, have not been altogether forthcoming about, the raw number of eggs that
right.
would be needed to do what they say is so promisingly standing out there just on the horizon of the future?
Well, it's quite interesting. If you take a look at the highest levels of biotech journals, you're now beginning to see some of the major players in this research field admitting, you know, therapeutic cloning is really impractical. It would be way too expensive to do. It's way too difficult. The efficiency wouldn't be there, and there would never be enough human eggs. You're beginning to see them admit that. But when they talk to the popular media, gee, somehow that never comes up, because there's more to this than just whether or not this research would work, and there's more to this more than just whether or not cloning is moral or immoral. There is also another part of this fight, which has to do with whether science is going to serve society or dominate it. There is a new philosophy that is really gaining steam, I believe, in research. It's not a new philosophy, but it's gaining new steam in the research community, biotech industry. It's called scientism. And it looks at science as the salvation of humankind. And so because the zealotry for science, for research, for the sake of it, the idea that behind scientism is that the lay public and the community, we don't have the right to tell scientists what they can and cannot do. They have a right, in fact, some call it a constitutional right akin to the First Amendment, to go wherever their intellectual curiosities take them. So regardless of whether these would lead to cures or not cures, or whether it would work or not work, there is something else going on here in terms of the rage at being thwarted from being able to do what they want when they want to. In fact, many scientists now say the only people who can decide what is moral in science are scientists. But you know, morality is not a science issue, as we started with. The local barber, the radio talk show host, the homemaker, and everyone else has just as much right to consider and weigh in on these issues of morality and ethics as do scientists.
Is there also behind this a view toward forestalling as much government regulation as possible when it comes to these things? I mean, they simply want to have an unregulated industry.
Right. They want unfettered access to do what they want. Now, right now, they're willing to say, well, we should outlaw cloning to produce children, reproductive cloning, because it isn't safe. And indeed, it isn't safe, because if you take a look at what's going on in the animals that are being cloned, constant defects in the animals, miscarriages, death of the birth mothers, almost all mammals, if not all mammals that have been cloned, including Dolly, were defective. And so they're saying, well, you know, no one wants to go forward with that. Well, there are actually people trying to go forward with that. But to me, that's a tactic, because they are not saying it is morally wrong, hence and hereafter, to create human babies through cloning. They are saying it isn't right now because it isn't safe. That's a big difference. And once it became safe, which, by the way, the very research they want access to do while they claim to be opposing reproductive cloning is the research that would need to be done to make reproductive cloning able to be done. Indeed, the South Korean researcher who created the first cloned human embryos said specifically that the embryos he had created could be used, if people wanted to create cloned babies. So it isn't just the idea of cloning for biomedical research that's wrong. If you believe it's wrong to create cloned babies, the cloning research is what is going to be necessary to achieve that end.
Wesley, you've pointed out in your recent article, Postmodernism Comes to Science, that this is not just what appears in the press or in the press releases of big biotech. These examples you've been talking about are often found in some of the most prestigious medical journals.
Let me give you an example. This will be a quick read. This is from the New England Journal of Medicine. The New England Journal of Medicine is one of the most prestigious medical journals in the world. It built its reputation on having good objective science in its pages. But recently it's been in high dudgeon about the idea that we're trying to outlaw all human cloning. It really opposes that. And the editor-in-chief, a man named Jeffrey M. Drazen, D-R-A-Z-E-N, in the July 17, 2003 edition, wrote an editorial in which he said it's unreasonable to prohibit human cloning for biomedical research. I have no problem with him having an opinion. Everybody has a right to express their opinions in a free country, right? And that side of the debate has as much a right to present its views robustly as my side of the debate. But here's where he went wrong. He went on to justify his position with junk science. Listen to this. He says, and this is about the science of human cloning. He wrote this, quote, "There are two distinct uses of embryonic stem cells. The first, for which there is no support among members of the scientific and medical communities, is the use of stem cells to create a genetically identical person, meaning a clone baby. The second use is to develop genetically compatible materials for the replacement of diseased tissues in patients with devastating medical conditions such as diabetes or Parkinson's disease. This is important work that must and will move forward." Well, that is just baloney. Embryonic stem cells are just cells. You could implant an embryonic stem cell in every woman of childbearing age in this world and never come up with one baby, because it's just a cell. What is created from cloning are embryos. And if you implant the embryos, that could end up with a baby. So you see right here in the New England Journal of Medicine, speaking primarily to doctors and scientists, this advocate misstated wildly. I'd flunk out of basic biology if I wrote a paper saying that a stem cell could create a pregnancy.
Wesley, these are peer-reviewed journals. He didn't only write that without someone. Everyone who's involved in the publication of these things does know better, don't they?
They do. I hope they do. I mean, this is astonishing. And what the irony, Todd, is that in these debates, so often, you will see the opponents of cloning and embryonic stem cell research federal funding for it. Speaking science accurately and then basing their morality based on accurate science. The scientists will misstate the science, as Drazen did in the piece I just read to you, but the media will treat it, well, they must know what they're doing because they're scientists. Well, good grief. Isn't this an ironic paradox? Here, we who oppose this research are accurate scientifically, and the scientists, who are supposed to be so rational and objective, are so filled with ideological zeal that they are willing to twist the science and actually undercut the very basis of scientific research to obtain a political victory.
Wesley, we have 2 minutes here before we have to go. I can make ethical judgments, but I need accurate information in matters
exactly.
of science, and I depend upon honest science to provide me with that accurate information.
Exactly.
What is at stake here?
What is at stake is not only the morality of our country in terms of these issues, what our public policy is, but I submit to you, what is at stake here is actually science itself. Because if scientists get into the habit of twisting and turning their definitions and indeed their research to because of a political or ideological purpose, then the very scientific method which has brought us so far from the days where people died at age 20 of burst appendixes is going to be completely undercut and undermined. One of the other things that's going on is sometimes we now see peer-reviewed journals edited or rewritten to prevent a political result they don't want, and so you end up with not even the proper information being shared. There was a journal, this was reported in the Washington Post, which surprised me a bit, but good for them, where about embryonic stem cells, there was going to be a report that these stem cells may contain anomalies, genetic problems, that might make it difficult for use in medical treatment. But this was when the big decision was coming up as to whether or not to do funding of embryonic stem cell research. And so the authors changed their conclusion so as to not have an impact on the political debate. But that isn't science. Science has to present the information and let the chips fall where they may, or it becomes advocacy and it cannot be trusted.
Wesley Smith, thank you for being our guest again on Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd, and hello to your audience.
Wesley Smith, attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, senior fellow for the Discovery Institute, author of several books, including Culture of Death, The Assault on Medical Ethics in America, and this article called Postmodernism Comes to Science. You can read this column on the web at wesleyjsmith.com. That website is wesleyjsmith.com. When we come back from this break, we have open lines for your questions and your comments. 1 hour of open lines to start out the first live day this week. It's April the 13th, Tuesday. We're back live here on Issues Etc. Open lines. What shall we do during open lines? Well, first, let's hear from Lieutenant General Richard Sanchez. He's commander of military operations in Iraq. Now, there's a Shiite shrine in Najaf, which is a holy city in and of itself, where radical Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, that's how I'm going to pronounce his name from now on. Well, he's holed up there. At least we believe and have every reason to believe that he is. What should we do? We have not struck these kind of targets before, but is it time to start? We're talking about that when we come back.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Why do you go to church?
To thank and praise God?
To get some spiritual motivation for a weary work week?
To obey God's command, remember the Sabbath day.
But is worship primarily about what we do, or is it about God's service to us?
Worship is the subject of our Issues Etc. book of the month for April. They Will See His Face. It's published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. They Will See His Face costs $12.99 plus shipping and handling, 1-800-325-3040. You can also order this book online at issuesetc.org. Just click the What's New section. They Will See His Face is a must-read for the worship wards. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. They Will See His Face, our Issues Etc. book of the month for April.
Now this Global Minute lets you hear a true story that prayer works. The story is found on worldwidekidsclub.com. In Haiti, a missionary family, the Buskins, was taking a much-needed break from their busy lives. They went swimming along the ocean shore, and one son, Jonathan, dove underwater. But he didn't know a boat was motoring straight towards him. At the same moment, back in the United States, the Buskins have a prayer partner named Doug Klein. He stopped at 1 p.m. and prayed for the family. At that very moment, everyone on shore caught the driver's attention, and he stopped the boat immediately before injuring or killing Jonathan. This story teaches us, and your kids, that prayer is powerful. It's included on the website worldwidekidsclub.com, along with music and mission activities. Get information to get your kids involved in missions. Visit the website worldwidekidsclub.com. That's worldwidekidsclub.com.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. It was the summer of 1954, and we were returning home from visiting relatives in Chicago. Brother Bruce and I, 3 and 7 years old respectively, were sleeping in the back seat of the blue 1953 Oldsmobile. "Wake up, look," Mom said. I did, and have not forgotten. Propped up on the beach of Lake Michigan, bathed in floodlights, 252 feet long and weighing 700 tons, was the German submarine U-505. Captured off Africa on June 4, 1944, it was being brought to the Museum of Science and Industry to become a permanent exhibit. Since its dedication on September 25th of that year, this memorial to the 55,000 sailors and merchant marines who died in two world wars has been visited by 23 million people. I talk about this because today is the final day of moving that U-boat from its place outdoors to a new indoor exhibit hall. How do you account for what you remember from your childhood? I don't know. But I have grown into this childhood memory, growing ever more grateful for the sailors and soldiers and all who gave, who give today, so that one family in an Oldsmobile and all American families can live and love in peace.
Hi, this is Paul Clayton. I bring you news and information, inspirational Christian favorites, and conversations with great guests Monday through Friday on The Morning Show on AM 850 KFUO. Plus, short features like, By the Way, our thought for the day from the Reverend Paul Devanteer, Front Porch Parenting with Dr. Mary Mance Simon, commentary from Dr. Dale Meyer, it's the Meyer Minute, plus Your Creation Moment. Features on The Morning Show on AM 850 KFUO.
Najaf, as we all know, is a holy city with a holy shrine there, and we are respecting the fact that there was a religious celebration ongoing.
That was Lieutenant General Richard Sanchez. He's commander of military operations in Iraq. Yesterday, he was talking about how coalition forces there don't want to damage a Shiite shrine in Najaf, the holy city in Iraq, where radical Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr has been evading coalition forces by staying next to the Imam Ali Shrine. Now, the shrine, it's one of the holiest Shiite shrines in Shiite Islam. There in Iraq, it's the third holiest in the world after Mecca and Medina in Saudi Arabia. It could be damaged if al-Sadr is targeted in an attack. And that's the question I have for you to start out this hour of Open Lines here. We have, I think, very consistently in Iraq been staying away from holy cities and holy sites, even though we've suspected for a long time, this is where weapons are being kept. This is where plans are being made. This is where bad guys are doing what bad guys do. And more as the bad guys dwindle in number and more as we eliminate other places where they could be hiding. Last week it was Fallujah, do you remember? And this week, a Shiite holy city, Najaf. Now, the person who has been coordinating the attacks against coalition forces has decided he is, in essence, going to claim sanctuary there in one of the Shiite shrines or around one of the Shiite shrines. He's using the shrine, if you will, as a shield. He knows that if you were in a house, we might just, drop a JDAM on the house. He knows that if he were in the streets, we might find a way of rounding him up and bringing him in. But if he hangs out at the shrine, the whole third holiest of shrines in Islam, next to Mecca and Medina, should we strike? Knowing the advantage it could bring or the disadvantage it could bring, given the fact that up to this point we have shown amazing restraint and respect for the holy places of Islam. That's a question for you here during Open Lines, Issues, etc., running for the next hour, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Now, a religious festival? We'll keep our hands off. But how long can we do it? What if it was Osama bin Laden who had decided in Afghanistan or in Pakistan to take refuge in a shrine? Been looking for that guy for a long time. We've been looking for al-Sadr for, well, there's been a warrant for his arrest for quite some time. We didn't know about it till recently. If the tables were turned in terms of religion, and these were bad men up to no good, under the flag of Christianity, flying under that banner, and they needed to be brought to justice and dealt with, and they took sanctuary in a Christian church. My gut says, look, shrine or no shrine, mosque or no mosque, if this is where the weapons are, if this is where the bad plans are being made, if this is where the bad guys are, we don't do anyone any favors, not the people of Iraq, not our coalition forces, by keeping our hands off the shrine and the holy places. What do you think? 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. A question I have for you that I will also be asking our guest in the very last half hour of Issues, etc., Robert Spencer, as we talk about Islam and the war with Iraq. Have we underestimated Islam in our foreign policy? Not as a social force, but as a religion. The president has said that he believes Islam is a religion of peace and that there are some minority radical elements. That may or may not be, but could it be that that's an underestimation of how much Islam, what the role of Islam is in the enmity that some of these Muslims in Iraq and elsewhere have toward the United States and other Western powers? If we had a more accurate picture of Islam as a religion, I'm not talking about missing information, I'm talking drawing the right conclusions. If Islam is not a religion of peace inhabited by a minority group of radicals who occasionally give people trouble and Islam a bad name, but if Islam is the beliefs and the teachings of Islam, if they are at the root of these activities, could we have a better foreign policy, a better military policy in Iraq if we changed our view of what Islam is really all about? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I'd like your answer to that question. Sooner or later, something's going to be done. Either we're going to allow him to flit from one holy place to another or stay there indefinitely, maybe a year out from now. He'll still be there, still be running operations from a holy site that we won't touch, or we'll deal with it and then, well, then you'll make up your mind. What do you think now? 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Is this one of those things where we know it's the best thing to do? The best thing to do politically is to let this guy stay in hiding there at the Shiite shrine in Najaf. He's the guy we're after this week. Eliminating him wouldn't take care of the problem, but it would certainly, well, do two things. It would send a message, and it would also probably disrupt the operations of those who are making it so hard on us over there. And hard on the Iraqi people, not to mention the Iraqi people, of course. So politically, it might be devastating if we hit a shrine. We would have to deal with outcry from all over the world. But if we want to do things right and not allow the bad guys to remain for a year thumbing their noses at us and doing worse to our coalition forces, maybe it's time to do the politically unpopular thing, the thing that we know will get us into trouble with the world, but the one that will do the job. What do you think? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. 2727. If this was, let's say, Osama bin Laden, we know that he is a native Saudi. And if he decided somehow to secret himself back to Saudi Arabia, and he took up residence, and we finally located him at Medina, the second holiest shrine in Islam, or Mecca, the holiest shrine in Islam. And he was there thumbing his nose at us and conducting al-Qaeda operations from there. Should we strike? 505-7851-800-730-2727. In about 50 minutes, Frank Beckwith joins us to talk about political correctness, and we'll find out the origins of that prevailing viewpoint. I'd like your thoughts on the situation in Iraq as it pertains to holy shrines, holy sites, and taking sanctuary therein. Let's start with Phil, who is calling from his car. Phil, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing well.
Well, comments, I think, are due that if the Islam religion is a religion of peace, if even a Shiite cleric goes against that, then we should hit him.
If he's even if he's hiding out in the third holiest city at their shrine?
Well, I guess you can define it as to major, minor shrines, you know, but even so, I would think the people there should get behind us and support us, that you shouldn't allow someone like that to participate in those kind of actions in their holy sites.
Phil, one question before I let you go. If this were a Christian extremist, flying under the banner of Christianity, and they were hiding out at a sacred Christian site, would you have the same judgment?
Yes.
Phil, thank you very much for the call. Good. Consistency there. Okay. Phil says it's time to do something. It's time to do something. Now, to this point, we have kept our hands pretty much off of mosques and holy sites. We didn't even send troops into Najaf. We didn't. We more or less bypassed the place. I mean, I'm not privy to the intimate details of our military strategy, but that's what the news reports. We did enter some mosques in Iraq, in Baghdad, but that's because, well, you know, that's where they were hiding the weapons. And everyone was looting everything, and we were trying to bring order. You remember those pictures of people coming out with the Quran that had apparently been trampled by U.S. soldiers and U.S. forces? But for the most part, we've stayed away. Should we continue to stay away even if the bad guys are hiding there? Roland is on the line. He's calling from St. Louis. Roland, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Maybe it's a simplistic solution, but I say we have a bunch of bracelets made up that say WWAD, and we distribute them, and we make them wonder what would Allah do.
What do you think they'd conclude?
I don't want it. Unfortunately, from what I know of the Quran, I think it would be the wrong thing.
Roland, thank you very much.
Sure.
That's an interesting thing. Have about much as much use as what would Jesus do? What are holy sites for? What are shrines for? Maybe, you know, you'd say as a Christian, a holy site or a shrine is not for bad people to hide out in. And not for them to misuse in that way. Our churches are not refuges or dens of thieves or murderers. Someone could ask for sanctuary, but the Christians therein would say, no, you have to answer for your crimes before the bar of justice sooner or later, but we will give you everything you need in terms of your bodily needs, but sooner or later you're going to have to answer for your crimes. They'd urge them to go out and face the law. That would be the answer from the Christian perspective, I think, in a nutshell. What would the answer from Islam be? What are your shrines for? Are they hiding places for bad guys? For insurrectionists? 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I asked the question of Phil when he called in first. If it were a Christian extremist flying under the banner of Christianity who is hiding out in a Christian holy place, let's think of a few places that are holy places, shrines, if you will, to Christians, someplace in the Holy Land. Would we be justified in striking? 505-7850-1-800-730-2727. A lot of things to talk about during open lines. One of the things I want to get to here in just a moment, did you hear about this? John Kerry was back in Boston for Easter. And the question of the day, there was actually what Christianity Today called Communion Watch. Communion Watch continues. They published an article early in the weekend saying, you know, we're kind of keeping an eye on what happens when John Kerry goes back to Boston, goes to church on Easter. Will he receive the Lord's Supper? Will he be communed? Will he get the Eucharist? Well, he did. And apparently the word came down from the Boston Archdiocese, not from the Archbishop himself, but from a spokesman saying, and I quote, John Kerry was as welcome as any other Catholic to receive the Eucharist. Now, apparently, there had been word on the street that Archbishop O'Malley, Sean O'Malley of Boston, had privately communicated with John Kerry saying, don't take the Lord's Supper. You remember when Kerry swung through here on a stop? He didn't go to a Catholic church. He went to a Baptist church where he delivered a sermon. But the Archbishop here in St. Louis said, don't try and take communion here. You're out of line with the church's teachings. He was communed anyway. And apparently the Archdiocese office didn't have a real problem with it. Or at least they're not saying they had a problem with it. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Rich is calling from his car. Rich, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thanks, Pastor. I think if the shoe was on the other foot, they would not hesitate to blow up one of our churches if we were hiding, doing the same thing. So
By they, who do you mean by they?
By the Muslims, the Iraqis. I think if the shoe was on the other foot, they would not hesitate if we were hiding, trying to do what they're doing in a sacred place. I don't think they would hesitate at all. I don't think we can hesitate.
Well, my question wasn't so much what would the Iraqis do or what would Muslims do, but what would our government be justified in doing if, say, let's talk about Spain for a second, okay? Just for the sake of argument. There are terrorists in Spain of all different kinds, as we very recently learned. What if they were holed up in one of the cathedrals in Spain saying, look, this is a holy site, this is a Christian holy site, and let's say they weren't Muslims, but they were, in fact, some sort of Christian extremist group. Would we be... I'm not talking about blowing the place to the ground, but I'm talking about going in and doing the job. What's that?
I think we'd have to go in and get them, whatever means we had to take to get them out of there.
Rich, thank you very much for your call. What about the rest of you? Give us a call at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. This was Wednesday last week. I was driving out, and this was right before they put a missile in the wall of the mosque at Fallujah. That morning, early in the morning, I was driving out, and I was listening to the radio, and I was hearing the reports of what was going on in Fallujah, and I had just heard the reports of what was going on in Ramadi, and all this strikes very close home for me, because my brother, having just very recently returned from Iraq after a year of service there as a captain and a combat engineer, had spent the last year in and around Ramadi on one of the points of the Sunni Triangle, a dangerous place to be. So I'm listening to all this, and I'm thinking to myself, we know where the weapons are. We know where a lot of the bad guys are. We know where a lot of the orders are being issued from mosques, from shrines, from holy sites. And I thought to myself, I mean, this was my initial reaction. We got to take off the gloves. It's time to start dropping a few bombs where the bombs will really do the most good. It won't be easy. There's going to be fallout. But if we want a quick solution, not a quick solution, but a timely solution, it's the only way to go. Maybe I'm wrong. What do you think? Keith is up next, calling from his car. Keith, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yeah, hi. Pastor, this is a little different, but I think quite similar. There's right across the river a center that does abortions and performs abortions, and I know there's people there every day from various Christian churches and individuals that go there. Do we have the right, knowing what's going on in there, to demand that the doctors come out and do what we should with them, and that the patients that are there seeking counsel and maybe having abortions come up? Just thought I'd ask you what you thought.
Keith, thank you very much. Well, legally, no. I mean, not as the laws stand, especially, for heaven's sakes, I am a resident of the state of Illinois, and say that with some degree of shame whenever the subject of Granite City and Hope Clinic comes up, because the laws there are so very lax. Well, what is it? Illinois has become an exporter of abortion on demand. People, you've heard the reports, haven't you? The Christians who very valiantly go down there and offer assistance to people who are thinking about having an abortion, they report that license plates are not all Illinois license plates. They're not even all Missouri license plates. Kentucky, Indiana, far-flung across the contiguous 48 states coming to Illinois because of its lax abortion laws. But legally now, no, Keith, sad to say, what they do in there, as bad as it is, as evil as it is, and as much as it should be judged a crime in not only Illinois but all of the United States, it is still, sad to say, legal. And that means our fight is taken not there in terms of doing what needs to be done, although the protesters should remain. Our fight is taken to those who make our laws. I don't think it's necessarily an equal comparison with the Iraqi situation, because we're talking about something that is not illegal, as wrong as it is. And under the occupying forces of the United States over in Iraq, what Muqtada al-Sadr is doing is illegal. It's not only illegal, it is terrorism, something that we barely even have the ability to write laws for. It is so illegal. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Up next, Nancy's been patiently waiting in Alton. Nancy, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Good afternoon. For a while, I had trouble with the idea of messing up the sacred cities or wherever they were across the world. But I just heard something this past week that, according to the Geneva Convention, if there is terrorists in weapons in a sacred shrine, we have, according to that, anyone, you're allowed to take it out. You're allowed to remove everybody, or if you have to, like we did the other week when we found those weapons, there you are allowed to do that, according to the Geneva Convention.
And I believe you're right there, Nancy. This is technically permissible. The question really has more to do with whether or not not whether we can, because we can. We would be within our rights if that's the way the Geneva Conventions actually read. We would be within our rights to do it. Should we? Just because you can do something doesn't necessarily mean you should. Just because you can do something doesn't necessarily mean it's the wisest thing to do. I'm asking you to think about this in terms of what kind of a problem does this create if we do nothing, and if we allow Muqtada al-Sadr to just stay there and essentially thumb his nose in direct operations of his army against coalition forces. We're weighing one thing against another, because if we do strike the shrine, it will be viewed not only as striking the shrine, but the whole city. If we do strike the shrine, there will be political fallout internationally. It might turn Shiites, we're talking about a majority, 80% of the population of Iraq are Shiites. If this was a Sunni problem, I don't think we'd be hesitating. If there were a Sunni holy site, we wouldn't be hesitating. In fact, I think probably if you look inside the Sunni triangle, we didn't. But the Shiites were a little more concerned about, because they're a vast number, not only there in Iraq, but also next door in probably a bigger problem than Iraq, Iran. And the whole Shiite world is watching. And they're looking, and they're saying, will the United States do this? What do you think about it? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Note, if it's against the Geneva Conventions, then obviously our hands are tied there. If it's against the commonly accepted rules governing how war is waged that we agree upon as nations, then our hands are tied. No one's saying our hands are tied legally. What stays the hand of I think essentially here we're talking about the commander-in-chief. This isn't going to happen unless George W. Bush signs off on it. And George W. Bush has said Islam is a religion of peace. But he's got a man of war hiding out in one of these shrines of peace. Are they fair game in times of war, the shrines and the holy sites? Give me a call, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. When we come back from this break, a little more sound for you to react to. This is from a pastor who, in Plain Township, Life in the Plain Township, Ohio, a church there decided, maybe they even heard about it last year, they decided that they would give away a car on Easter. They wanted to bring some people in. We'll hear about that from the pastor. Well, the car went to someone a little too young to drive, a 9-year-old girl. She decided to give the car, because she couldn't drive it, she decided to give the car to the woman who had invited her to church. The pastor, now this goes to the question of what you heard preached on Easter Sunday, the pastor said it went right along with their message, the giving away of the car and the little girl's reaction, the message of Easter. He said, Jesus holds the keys of death and hell, character counts. Is that what you heard yesterday on Easter Sunday? Did you hear character counts? It sounds to me like a faith-based initiative. It sounds to me like a DARE program, not a sermon on Easter Sunday. Yeah, Jesus does hold the keys of death and hell, but he saw a real connection here. You know, keys, car keys, handing over the keys, giving away the car. Then the little girl turns around. Apparently she got the message that this is all about handing over keys. She hands them over to the woman who brought her to church. Some very interesting comments on the message and how a lesson was learned by one and all, young and old, on Easter Sunday in Ohio when we come back from this break. Open lines for your questions and your comments. Anything you want to talk about, we're coming to you live Tuesday, the 13th of April, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And if you still have some thoughts on whether or not we ought to strike the holy city and the holy shrine in Najaf, where one of the bad guys of the week is holed up, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. After 25 minutes of open lines, Frank Beckwith will join us for an hour talking about political correctness, where it came from. What is it really? We know it when we hear it. We know it when we see it. But how do you define political correctness? And then the last half hour of Issues, Etc., we'll spend with Robert Spencer. We will revisit the Iraq question and the question of Islam with him in the last 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. Call during this break. We'll be right back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.